Bet the Board in conjunction with NASCAR presents Stay Green. Stay Green is your first stop for all the metrics, matchups, and money-making opportunities at the track each race week. This is Stay Green, the NASCAR betting podcast. Here are your hosts, Todd Furman and racing analyst Chris Wormy.
Welcome into the Stay Green podcast, a Bet the Board production in conjunction with NASCAR. And then there were two races remaining in the NASCAR postseason before we'll crown a champion next weekend at Phoenix. But before we get there, a full race to break down from Martinsville this weekend. I'm your host, Todd Furman, joined as always by racing analyst and professional sports bettor Chris Wormy. And Wormser, we're going to let you take your victory lap because it's well-earned for the call on Kyle Larson to grab the checkered flag at Homestead. But this week, I just want to make sure that you come armed with actual facts and data rather than willing things to actually manifest on the track. When you said Kyle Larson had one of the best cars you'd ever seen, when I'm not sure he was better than 10th, the Homestead race you were referring to.
I believe that my comment was the most dominant car from a laps led perspective in NASCAR history. And when you said that, you called me out, which obviously I need people in my life to do that. And I went back and looked, and I think I stopped counting at like eight other seasons that had more laps led than Kyle Larson. And at that point, I sent you a text like, I got to get out ahead of this bad news or this claim. So fortunately, it was nice to kind of get even at Homestead. And man, what a fast car. I was really happy. I love this racetrack. And Larson's, I would say that I lean towards him as my favorite driver, and to see it kind of come together. And then for him to say something like, you know, it on live TV, like, well, that was an ass beating. I kind of was like fist pumping for sure.
Yeah, that five car was absolutely dominant and arguably one of the most impressive performances we've seen all season long as far as the next gen car was concerned. And the reason I say that is that even when Kyle Larson got shuffled back into dirty air, there was very little doubt he had the fastest car. And if things had stayed green, there was going to be ample opportunity for him to race to the front of the field with enough laps led. We'll get to that breakdown. And as we always do around here, stage one, it's all about recapping the most recent race, and that, of course, was Homestead. Stage two, as we've done throughout the course of the postseason, a little bit of a playoff reset. And stage three, we'll shift all of our focus towards Martinsville and what we can anticipate in this, an elimination race, and how it may or may not be different than what we saw at the paperclip in the spring. So going back to Kyle Larson in terms of his overall performance, Worm, you look at his price early in the week, 10-1. He goes off on race day in that 7.5-1 range. He was dominant from start to finish, but it wasn't without a little bit of drama when he spins Martin Truex Jr. on pit road late in that race. And a part of me went, here we go. I'm a little bit nervous how NASCAR is going to handle this. Is there going to be discipline on the track? But you loved hearing the comments from the 19 after the race was over. Didn't blame Kyle Larson the same way his race team and Joe Gibbs actually wanted to do. Said a lot of that fell on him, that he may have missed his pit box given the way that the sun reflected off his windshield at Homestead.
I remember looking at the TV and thinking, what just happened? Like, did Larson spin him out? Like, it was kind of ironic. I mean, he got into Martin's, you know, he left hooked Martin Truex into his pit box after, you know, a week after he was right hooked into the wall that cost, you know, Bubba Wallace the race suspension. But I mean, if you look at it, I was really happy that Martin Truex Jr. came out and said, hey, you know, I kind of hit the brakes, and it's just not something you've seen very often, but that sun is a big deal at that track. But what a rocket ship that five was. I mean, 150 driver rating, which is a perfect driver rating, which is honestly low in my opinion. Like, it was a perfect driver rating, but nah, it was actually better than that. Daniel Cespedes, who's an intern at NASCAR, I feel comfortable, you know, actually looking at this tweet and saying he's right because he's a junior at Dartmouth, and so he's for sure the smartest in the group here out of us three. And
that doesn't take a whole heck of a lot, so don't sell him short.
Yeah, but he said Kyle Larson led 74.5 of the laps at Homestead today. That's the highest percentage of laps led by a race winner this season. The second was 52% at Byron at Martinsville. No other driver has even come close to 60% of the laps this year. And the crazy thing about that is, if there wasn't a caution that came out within like a 3-second time period, he leads all those laps that Martin Truex led. And he actually leads like 85% of the laps. I mean, this was domination like, you know, we haven't seen in this sport in a while. And it was nice to see the best car win. Not that it doesn't happen. Not that that happens week in and week out where you don't see the best car win. But it was nice to see a car that's that fast get rewarded with a victory. And the fact that it was, you know, Larson at Homestead made it all that much better for me.
And you sent me an interesting infographic that I think is worth relating to our audience about if there hadn't been stage breaks and if we'd had much longer green flag runs, how dominant that five car really was, that there may have only been a small fraction of other drivers that were actually able to stay on the lead lap.
Well, they only showed the metric with the 1 and the 19 in comparison. And I think I'm reading this properly when I say there's only one car that would have been one lap down, and that would have been the 19. And there only would have been one car that was two laps down, and that would have been the 1. And I'm under the impression that everyone else would have been three laps down. And when I was listening to Door Bumper Clear, there were some guys that were saying, no, I don't think so. And I can't remember who came out and said, he was half a second faster than the field under green flag conditions after 20 laps. And you just don't see that very often. And I don't know how many times I heard Cliff Daniels come on the radio and say, you know, every other lap, okay, you have a 1 second lead. Okay, you have a 2 second lead. You have a 3 second lead. Okay, Kyle, keep it off the wall. You have a 4 second lead. And then, you know, towards the end of the stage, he was like, Kyle, you have a 9 second lead. Just keep it off the wall, please. Just smooth. And, you know, that smooth said a lot. And it was just great to see I almost said the 42. It was great to see the 5 get to victory lane at Homestead.
Yeah, he went out there, earned his keep after a rough finish to the race the previous week in Las Vegas, given the unfortunate incident with Bubba Wallace. When you look at the rest of the top 5, you mentioned the 1 car of Ross Chastain. He finishes 2nd. AJ Allmendinger in the 16 finishes 3rd. Austin Dillon comes home 4th. And Brad Keselowski rounded out the top 5. Pretty impressive that it was the first top 5 finish of the year for that 6 car. And Brad Keselowski, along with Chris Buescher, starting around in a form, maybe a team to watch as you go into the offseason and figure out what they're going to unload with for the 2023 season. The other thing for me, you know, as what's been a season of what can go wrong has gone wrong for Martin Truex and his 19 team, what I was thinking, Worm, is how much different the season could have been for him if he's able to end up on the right side of the cut line in Daytona, knowing that he came up just short there, that the 19 would have been an ideal spot to head into Martinsville with a chance to race his way into the final 4. And you can make the case that he might be one of the most dangerous drivers going, given what we've seen from him in back-to-back races at mile-and-a-half tracks.
Oh, I think you have to say that about all mile-and-a-half tracks in the playoffs, that there was a point at every one of those races at Kansas, Texas and Vegas, where Martin Truex Jr. was the fastest car, and they just couldn't get anything right, you know, kind of all season. It seemed like, yeah, like whatever can go wrong will. And it's kind of a bummer because you can tell Truex is kind of down. You can just tell in the way that he talks. It's kind of like, well, that's just the way things are going. But it's certainly not for a lack of speed. Now, unfortunately, you know, he was the second best car. There was no world in which I think Martin Truex Jr. holds off Kyle Larson, even if that last caution doesn't come.
Yeah.
You know, the only people that say that are Martin Truex Jr. fans or the people that bet on him. Because you might have to check with your bias if you think that he was going to be able to hold off a car that was half a second faster over the long run. But, man, it's just crazy how that 19 team just hasn't put everything together. And it goes to show you just how hard these races are to win. You know, having speed in your car is one element of many that you need in order to win races at this series. So I do want to touch base on just these, the Chastain, Dinger, Dillon, and Keselowski. Austin Dillon, arguably, in my opinion, had the third best car. It was hard to pass. You know, everyone's running that same line. He started 32nd. He drove his way up into the top 10. Then under a green flag stop, he had a 23-second stop and was forced to go back to, I don't know, was it 22nd or 23rd, and then drove his way under green flag conditions back up to the top five. I mean, that was a great run for that three team. I think that there's nothing but good things to come for that whole RCR organization. You know, Keselowski with a great run and not a great starting spot. Super impressive. And Ross Chastain, I mean, you know, looking at the last finishes for this guy, they've been pretty darn good. You know, second at Homestead, second at Vegas. I know that he had the issues at the Roval, but fourth at Talladega, 13 at Texas, sixth at Bristol, seventh at Kansas. I mean, those are some pretty good, that's some pretty good momentum heading into these final two races. I expect him to just run well. So a great weekend for all of those guys. And let's just say AJ Allmendinger's the real deal. And I'm just going to leave it at that.
Yeah, I mean, AJ, as we've talked about, and I'm sure when we get into next season's preview, there is no doubt that the 16 will be a guy that we're very interested to see how he's priced and how odds makers go about trying to set up realistic expectations for his 2023 season outlook. I did want to try and touch on some of the other playoff drivers, obviously, as you went through the top five. Denny Hamlin, the only other one on the right side of the cut line in the top eight that finishes inside the top 10, coming home P7. When you look at the other drivers, Chase Briscoe finished 36. He's now put himself in a win or go home type scenario. We talked a little bit about Martin Truex, and JGR in general has brought speed to the mile and a half tracks, which I think is good to see. Were you surprised that you didn't get more out of some of the playoff drivers, that you got such lackluster finishes? Maybe not from HMS, because we talked about some of the fear and the way that Chase Elliott was being overvalued, but still at the same time, when you have eight playoff drivers and only two finish inside the top 10, it does raise your eyebrow a little bit.
Yeah, I thought Hamlin was going to be better. I know that I was, you know, on him in a matchup or two. And, you know, I knew that he didn't have a ton of short run speed, but I didn't realize how much that would hurt him on restarts. You know, he spent most of these runs just grinding back positions that he had lost on restarts. And it, like I said, these races are tough to win. And if you're constantly repassing guys that you've passed earlier, that's kind of a recipe for disaster, because that means you're really pushing your car a little bit harder on those shorter runs. Now, he was still good on the long run. You know, I think he was probably a sixth or seventh place car. But, you know, in practice, he looked like a top three car to me. So I don't, even though he did get the finish, you know, a P7, which could have been a worse day, in my opinion, based on how much he had to grind. You know, he was struggling on pit road, and he wasn't picking up positions, and he was losing positions on restarts. His nickname should be the Grinder, because that's just how it's been in the playoffs for him this year. There's been mistakes. He's just would grind his way back. And I'd really like to see him in the championship four, but you know, it's not going to be easy, that's for sure.
I mean, you look at what Denny has done so far this postseason: second at Darlington, second at Kansas, ninth at Bristol, 10th at Texas, 5th at Talladega, 13th at the Roval, 5th at Vegas, 7th at Homestead. Clearly, this is a guy who hasn't put it all together. We've talked about the speed. If he actually does at Martinsville this weekend, or should he make the final four at Phoenix, going to be a very difficult out. I'll wave the white flag here with one to go on stage one. I want to ask you about one of Denny's teammates. We've seen that it doesn't appear to be this harmonious breakup where Kyle Busch is willing to go on his merry way as a member of RCR. We know he's going to be driving the 8 car next season. You wonder what he'll be able to contribute to the overall efforts from both Denny Hamlin and Christopher Bell in their quest to get into that final four at Phoenix. But when you look at Kyle Busch, quietly third place, ninth place, do you think he's racing with a chip on his shoulder to try and take some of that momentum into his new ride in 2023?
I don't know. I mean, there were some comments that were made on that, you know, race for the championship, and it just kind of looked a little kind of offhanded towards, you know, Gibbs. And listen, I don't know if there's going to be drama. It wouldn't surprise me. I certainly think he wants his team to win, but I think Kyle Busch is looking out for number one. And I think that, you know, to go back to Austin Dillon, I think he has to be super excited about his future at RCR. You know, I think Tyler Reddick's a great driver, and he's done a lot to get that whole organization in a better position with more speed. But Kyle Busch is a way better driver and a way better communicator than Tyler Reddick. And I think that Austin Dillon has to be super excited looking into next year, saying, hey, I've got speed in my race car. If we can clean up a few things with Kyle Busch's help and his feedback, we might be able to win races the old-fashioned way, which is not with fuel and not a restrictor plate race. Like, he can actually go out there and win races on ovals and be competitive. And I'm very bullish on 83 next week, or next year, I should say.
Yeah, I mean, we have seen the parity in the sport, and clearly one off season where all these teams are able to go back to the R&D center and figure out exactly things that they did well this year versus what they want to improve going forward will make for one of the more fascinating off seasons in recent memory with NASCAR. I want to remind all of you, our loyal Stay Green listeners, to follow Chris on Twitter. That's at ChrisWormy15. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, as always, for all things Bet the Board Pod, follow Bet the Board Pod on Twitter. And Worm, as we shift our focus towards stage two and a de facto playoff reset, we talk about the winner go home mentality. We know that's the situation that'll be staring Chase Briscoe in the eye, Christopher Bell in a very similar spot. When you look at Ross Chastain, Chase Elliott, William Byron, they're on the right side of the cut line by the slimmest of margins. There's Denny Hamlin sitting in fifth place, 5 points below William Byron. Blaney is 18 points below the provisional cut line, Bell 33, and Briscoe by 44. As you start to assess those drivers, how do the guys on the right side of the cut line versus the wrong side potentially go about approaching this race? And most importantly, will it impact some of the handicap overall in the big picture for the outright market, or maybe even in the head-to-head matchups, before we get into some of the driver-specific stats that we'll touch on in stage three?
The only time I could see this In the way that I think that this race is going to play out, I think that tires aren't going to matter much. I think you're going to look at drivers once they get into that fuel window. They're going to pit whenever there's a chance. If it's green flag, great, for fuel. But once they get into that fuel window, nobody's going to pit again. If everything that, we kind of anticipate, if we, make the assumption that tires aren't going to fall off and it's going to be hard to pass, track position is going to be everything. But it will be interesting if there's a caution with like 15 to go in a stage where, a lot of the leaders under normal circumstances would probably pit, take the tires, and then stay out at the caution. Whereas you might see some guys like Briscoe or Hamlin or, Bell. Bell probably has to win the race, so he's going to do everything he can to win the race along with Briscoe. But I think Blaney and Hamlin, there's a chance if they don't have race-winning cars that they'll actually stay out and hope that they can get those stage points and then hope that maybe those 15 or 20 lap fresher tires pay dividends in the future. That's the only time I can see the playoff drivers changing the outright market. The other thing might be is maybe qualifying is going to be, they're going to put so much importance on qualifying that they set that car up for short runs and just hope like hell they qualify in the top five, because that makes their day way easier.
Yeah, I mean, you mentioned the importance of qualifying, and I think this, more than any race we've seen all season, if the test is any indication, what we saw unfold in the spring provides a lens through which we're going to view this race. Passing will be extremely difficult. Now, the one thing that we did see with the test is that it rubbered up quite nicely, but Joey Logano and some of the other drivers were pretty quick to say that, hey, look, there wasn't nearly the fall off they expected. They're trying to figure out the shifting situation and how they can get that rectified. But by all intents and purposes, I'm not sure we're going to see a lot of jockeying on the track and the ability for these cars to differentiate themselves from one another. As we look at the updated odds to win the championship for the season, Chase Elliott remains the favorite, and we actually saw his price shorten after the race at Homestead. He's now down in that plus $1.75, 2-1 range. Joey Logano drifted out a touch at 3-1. Ross Chastain becomes the beneficiary of his second place finish in a row in that 4.5 to 5-1 range. Denny Hamlin behind him in that 5.5-6 range. William Byron plus 650 thereabouts. And then we get into a trio of long shots between Ryan Blaney at 30-1, Christopher Bell 100-1, and Chase Briscoe at 300-1. I don't think you're going to advocate for Briscoe, but I'm going to ask the same question that I've asked you every single week as we continue to see these odds get adjusted. Is there anything from this particular list that catches your eye, or what kind of prices would you need on one of these eight drivers to tie up your capital going into Martinsville in anticipation of where you think their price will open to potentially win a championship at Phoenix?
Todd, when I look at Chase Elliott's odds, am I missing something? when I say these words, can we make an assumption that in order to win the championship, you have to win at Phoenix, right?
Yep. I think that is a very fair
assumption that we can all say
for how we've seen in this current format. No doubt about
it. Do you think Chase Elliott's going to be plus 175 at Phoenix?
I do not anticipate him him opening at such short odds. If he does, I might be inclined to take the field and lay upwards of 220.
Okay, so when you're looking at these odds, it's so important to realize that they still have to win at Phoenix. And if you're going to take a bet on a championship contender, I don't care if they're already through to Phoenix, like Joey Logano. Well, Joey Logano's not going to be 3-1 to win at Phoenix. It's not. He's going to be like 4 or 5 to 1, I would imagine. So why would you ever take that 3-1 price? I mean, I think if you look at, you know, Chase Elliott plus 175, that's terrible. I'd lay against that. Joey Logano, I guess I could understand if you think he's going to qualify well at Phoenix and he's going to be super, super low odds. But in order to bet these guys like Denny and Ross, you just have to make the assumption that they're going to be lower than those odds to win the race. Am I wrong about that? Am I missing something?
No, I think you have to look at it through two different vehicles, though, because as we'll see and we'll cover in great detail this time next week, you're going to have your odds to win the championship, which will be consisting of four drivers. You'll see them with slightly longer odds to actually win the race. But I do think there is, on some level, a one-to-one parallel that the driver that has to go out there and win at Phoenix will most likely be your champion. Now, there is, of course, always this scenario where, hey, look, you win the championship, you come in second or third. We just haven't seen that really unfold. So I think anybody who's approaching those particular betting markets when we actually have prices available there has to go in with the mindset that you're going to bet, let's call it 75% on them to win the outright in that market. And then if you believe in that particular driver, you allocate 25% of that particular position to win the championship. So that way your bases are at least covered. And regardless of how that thing plays out, that you're going to be profitable. I guess the logical follow-up I have for you there is if you're looking at the eight drivers now, and of course we know certain things have to happen for the likes of Christopher Bell, Chase Briscoe, and Ryan Blaney to some extent to get into that championship four, Chase Elliott will open the favorite, I would assume. Can you see a scenario where Chase wouldn't open the favorite at Phoenix if he is in the final four?
I think if Denny Hamlin gets in, I think he should be the favorite. That's just my opinion. You know, Denny ran well at Richmond, and I feel like that's probably a pretty close comp track. I know it's not completely identical, but I would just say Denny's history there. I know Chase has been good there, but I just think that Denny has kind of the X factor that Chase doesn't have when it comes to trying to get this championship. Yeah, I think Denny Hamlin would be the favorite if he got in. Otherwise, you have to make Chase Elliott the favorite. You know, when it comes to value, I guess I do think Chris Bell, you know, if this isn't a great track for him, but he's 12-1 to win this race. But if he does win this race, he's going to be 6-1 to win at Phoenix. So having a 100-1 ticket on Chris Bell, I think, is way better than betting him to win this race. Does that make sense? So it's kind of the opposite of Chase Elliott.
It does. It essentially becomes what would amount to a two-race parlay. That if you're betting Christopher Bell at 100-1, this is the first leg because he's got to win it to get in there. I don't see a scenario, unless something ridiculous happens, that he can point his way into Phoenix at this point. We've seen him with his back against the wall at the Roval go out there and exceed odds makers' expectations at a good price. So it'll be fascinating to try and see that. And this is kind of what goes into the calculus as a sports bettor that wants to do this seriously. When you try and identify what prices are available to you now, how you can maximize the potential ROI versus waiting up race, trying to figure out, I'm willing to take a shorter price, eliminate some of the variables in the equation, and put myself in what we define in the gambling space as a plus EV situation. So a lot to factor in this particular race, not only from the head-to-head standpoint, but some of the derivative markets and everything that will be available. As we always do in stage two, we wave the white flag and offer you a full track schedule and what you can expect to see come this weekend from Martinsville. And you'll see things kick off on Friday in earnest, or later today, I should say. At 4 o'clock Eastern time, Xfinity Series practice gets underway on USA Network. That'll run right into Xfinity Series qualifying that you can see on USA as well. Meanwhile, on Saturday, the Cup boys will get on track at noon Eastern. Cup Series practice will go from about noon to 12:45. That can be seen on USA Network and, as always, as part of the Motor Racing Network and Sirius XM NASCAR Radio. Right after that, we'll go into Cup Series qualifying. You can see that on the same networks. And then the Xfinity Series race and elimination consolation race for those boys as well to see who ends up punching their ticket to Phoenix. 250 laps, 131 miles. That race will be televised on NBC. And of course, the culmination of a race weekend at Martinsville, Sunday, October 30th, 2 p.m. Eastern, the Cup Series race. They'll drop the green flag. 500 laps, which is the traditional distance, compared to the 400 laps that we saw at Martinsville in the spring. 263 miles. You can see that on NBC, and that'll, of course, lead right into Football Night in America, as it always does, because I know people will be waiting with bated breath to see the Green Bay Packers take on the Buffalo Bills. Again, you can follow Chris on Twitter. That's at ChrisWormy15. I'm Todd Furman. You can follow me there. Most importantly, follow the podcast. When you look at Stage 3, Worm, this is always where we'll do our deep dive on the upcoming race. And Martinsville, hey, it's a short track. It is one of the quintessential NASCAR tracks. They call it the paperclip. You have long straightaways. You have flat corners. And it's going to place an emphasis on braking for a lot of these drivers. We can only hope that we get a little bit more passing than what we've seen. Denny Hamlin is the only one of the remaining championship eight drivers with more than one victory at Martinsville. He's won on the short track five times. The problem being is it's been quite some time since the 11 has found victory lane. When you look at Joey Logano, William Byron, Chase Elliott, they all have one win each. And the other four drivers, Ryan Blaney, Ross Chastain, Chase Briscoe, and Christopher Bell, they're looking for their first victories at the paperclip. And I know we talk a little bit about the spring race. We try and make some of those comparison. On a tight half-mile track that typically produces compelling racing, there were a grand total of four leaders. William Byron led 212 laps, Chase Elliott 185, Ryan Blaney 5, and Austin Dillon 1. There were a grand total of five lead changes compared to 15 in last year's fall race. There was a little bit of jousting for the lead in April, with Byron outrunning Joey Logano in overtime for the victory. And like we said, this race, 100 laps longer than what we saw in the spring. I mean, I guess the overarching question, you never want to go in nervous as a handicapper and obviously not as a driver. Should we be optimistic that we're going to see good racing on Sunday, or are we setting ourselves up for failure if we go in with that expectation that suddenly we're going to pull a full 180?
I'm going to be cautiously optimistic. I know that there were a lot of drivers that thought that based on the Homestead test that it would be hard to pass, and that there would be, you know, Penske guys and Denny Hamlin would be the best. And we didn't quite see that. So I do know that the fact that it was 40 degrees for that first Martinsville race definitely played a part in the lack of tire fall off. I know that they're bringing a different tire. But I think that it's important to recognize it's not only that at the beginning of the season, these teams are put in a box on the adjustments that they're able to make to the car. And that was to make sure that you kind of bring the field closer together. And early in the season, there were teams that were really, really fast, like Trackhouse, and there were teams like, Stuart Haas that struggled early on in that season. And what you've seen is you've seen teams like Stuart Haas, and I'm not choosing them out of, you know, but teams have kind of closed the gap. And it's the faster teams have gotten marginally better, where some of the slower teams have, or some of the teams that were slower in the year, have made larger gains to kind of make the field more even. So not only do you have less tire fall off, you actually have a field that is as competitive as we've ever seen in NASCAR. And whenever you have lap times, even if there's fall off or not, if the fall off is consistent among all teams, you're still going to see a very low amount of passes. So I think that not only is the car, but the tire, you throw those two things together and you do have kind of a conveyor belt. And I think that's what we saw last, we didn't see a pass for the lead in April. You know, we saw William Byron, who was fast for sure, but he won the race off pit road. And he did not pass him anybody. He didn't pass Chase under green. So I think that there's a fear of that. And you know what? Like, it ain't the track's fault. You know, there's some things that we have to do, or not we. I say that like we, like I'm a part of NASCAR. But there's
are they calling you? Are they getting you into the wind tunnel to try and figure this out? Are you on those conference calls with Goodyear?
Yeah, Chad Knaus called me the other day and said, hey, Worm, we're really struggling here. Do you think you could help us out? No, that does not happen. But I just think that, you know, that with teams put in a box and only so many adjustments that you can make, it's brought the field closer together. And And you see that more in these short tracks, more than you would see at a mile and a half with tire wear. So I'm optimistic because I know that it's going to be a little bit warmer this weekend than it was earlier in the year. And they do have a tire that was meant to put some more rubber down. I know we didn't see fall off, but I'm going to stay optimistic. Everyone said that it was going to be super hard to pass at Homestead. And not that it was easy, but there were cars that were able to make passes. I mean, Austin Dillon worked through the field twice. Brad Keselowski was able to work through the field. And Kyle Larson obviously was able to work through the field whenever he lost track position.
Well, I mean, what's fascinating about it, in the wake of that test, you had a variety of drivers speak out, and I think Chase Briscoe's comments kind of resonated with me, which provides a logical follow-up. So Chase more or less said, if you can get track position and maintain it, it's going to be easy, I think, to be able to control the race. We talked a little bit about qualifying and the importance that teams are going to have to place on it to get track position to start the race here. When you go about approaching this, are you less likely to take a position or two pre-week, hoping that you can catch lightning in a bottle with a particular driver? Or do you feel that there's going to be an overreaction in the betting market that's going to allow you to extract a little bit more value if a driver that you've identified going in is going to be starting deeper in the field, say 15th or 16th on the grid?
I think that there's too many unknowns to make a prediction on that quite yet. I'll say this. I would not take anyone under 15-1 to win the race. I think that there might be some value on some higher odds guys that might just be, you know, mispriced. But, you know, I think that any number of guys, I wouldn't be shocked if, you know, Chase, Denny, Blaney, Byron, Logano all qualified on the pole. You know, whichever one of those guys qualifies in the poll, well, they're going to be the favorite, you know, and they're probably going to be 6-1 would be my guess. So I think you could throw a blanket over a lot of those guys. Now, I don't know that there's any information that says go run to the window and bet Ryan Blaney 8-1 now because he's going to pull it. I just don't know. We don't have kind of that qualifying data yet on this tire in this temperature. And so I think it'll be the usual suspects, but it could be any one of the usual suspects that I just named that goes out there and qualifies well. And so I'm not willing to get involved quite yet unless you see someone that's just, you know, not properly priced at, you know, maybe the 30 or 40-1 range.
Well, let's throw a blanket over some of those guys that you mentioned and kind of go through them one by one to make a case either for or against when you're looking at some of the specifics there. Denny Hamlin, 7-1, we'll call the consensus price on him. Only one of the playoff drivers with more than one career win at Martinsville, but that's not the entire story, as we kind of alluded to. Hamlin's Martinsville wins occurred in 2008, 2009, 2010. He swept the season series there in 2015. In the past five races at Martinsville, he has finished 11th or worse four times, finished 28th in the spring, and what was more troubling about that performance, he never even got himself into the top 10 at any point during the race. Denny Hamlin at 7-1, I mean, definition of overvalued in your estimation right now?
Absolutely. I mean, there's nothing that says that Denny should be the favorite. Now, you know, it would be one thing if from the test, all the teams or all the drivers were talking about, well, the 11, once he gets to Martinsville, he looked great and really separated himself from the field. But that just didn't happen. And I think that he's as concerned as anyone right now. And I tried to think back, you know, he obviously struggled here in the spring. And then in 2020, he did the same thing. I don't know if you remember, you know, I don't know if I think it was the COVID kind of period when they ran at Martinsville. And the only reason I remember this is because him and Corey LaJoie had got into like a Twitter feud. And I remember LaJoie then passed Hamlin straight up that following week at Martinsville, Denny's best track. And it was like, whoa, that's kind of ironic. So I went back to look to see if Denny actually was able to improve that. I think he finished 24th that week. And I went back and looked, and he ended up finishing 11th in the fall, but he still only had like the 10th best driver rating. And he did start fourth. He got to second. And then when he finished the race, he was in 11th. So it's not like it was just this isolated incident that had Denny running poorly. I think that there's just something with these cars over the last few years that he tends to struggle with. And I just think that you should not be getting involved with Denny Hamlin at 7-1. Now, if he puts it on the pole and says he has a great car and he goes off at 5-1, well, I would pound that. So I am willing to wait on this Denny Hamlin price to see what happens after, you know, practice and qualifying.
makes a ton of sense. I mean, obviously you want to know the kind of piece he's going to be able to bring to the track and actually race with after we see a little bit more data start to materialize during practice and qualifying on Saturday. Ross Chastain, 14-1. As we mentioned, Chastain has finished second back-to-back weeks. He's plus 19 in terms of the cut line. Appears to be channeling his aggression at the same time. Not racing stupid, knowing what's at stake this postseason, but regaining some of that form and swagger that we saw early in the year that's made him a force to be reckoned with.
Yeah, well, look who's just kind of running clean races and getting some great finishes. I actually kind of like this price on Chastain. I'm not going to move on anything yet, just because Chastain doesn't particularly qualify well. Not to mention he qualified 27th in the spring, but he was able to pass cars. I mean, he got a fifth place finish, and you know his driver rating wasn't great, but he was able to pass cars, and I think that's the number one thing that you have to look at when handicapping these drivers. I would throw driver rating away. I would take a look at fastest laps and probably just the ability to move through the field. There were a few guys that were able to do it, and Ross Chastain was one of them.
And Chastain, when you look at his consistency so far this playoffs, if you throw out the 20th he had at Darlington, that was arguably his worst finish. The 37th at the Roval is what it is. He was able to kind of eliminate, you know, some of that in an elimination race, knew that he just had to basically start and park to get himself into the round of eight. When you look at a pair of HMS drivers, we know the emphasis that Rick Hendrick places on the importance of this track, especially given its prominent placement as an elimination race to get to the final four. Chase Elliott finds himself in that 6-1 range. He did win the 2020 fall race en route to the championship four appearance. He also has four top fives in his last seven Martinsville starts, three of them actually being in the top two. Another mediocre race at Homestead, finished 14th and failed to lead a lap. He's plus 11 to the cut line. When you look at the Hendrick drivers, I mean, these guys have gone out there and raced well. William Byron we'll get to in a second. Chase Elliott, 6-1. Fair price, or again, like Denny Hamlin, a little bit overvalued?
I think a little bit overvalued, although I do think that it's a little better than that Denny price, and here's why. Chase qualifies really well here, and I anticipate that to happen again, you know, this week. The thing with Chase, though, is he was kind of running fourth or fifth, you know, all race at Homestead, but the minute he was shuffled back in traffic, he didn't pass a soul. So I'm wondering, you know, if this Chase performance that we saw in the spring, which it's not like it was amazing or anything, but he did lead a lot of laps and he had a lot of fast laps. You know, was that just a product of the fact that he was in clean air the whole time? So I think that, you know, there's a really good chance. Now, Chase Elliott can win this race, don't get me wrong, but he really hasn't been tested. And I just think that, you know, to get involved at 6-1, I'd way rather see him, you know, see his practice times and see his qualifying, because where's he going to go from 6-1? Even if he pulls it, he might be 4. And he'd have to have a really good car for me to get behind him at 4. But you're not losing that much value. Whereas at 6-1, before practice and qualifying, I feel like it's too much of a risk.
Yeah, and it makes a ton of sense. It's all about price, and this price doesn't warrant an investment, at least right now, until you know what the 9 will be racing with come Sunday afternoon. William Byron, his teammate, sees a price a little bit longer at 8-1, one here in the spring. Five top eights in his last six Martinsville starts, including a runner-up in the playoff race in 2019, fourth and fifth, respectively last year, and a win in the spring race this year. He scored two top five finishes in 2021 and two top 10 finishes in 2020. What's crazy about William Byron, and I was blown away by this number, I mean, I chart everything, we pay attention to all of it. He's finished 12th, 16th, 13th, as I'm looking at some of these things, 12th, 13th, 16th, 12th in his last 4 weeks. Just one top five finish in the last 26 points paying races. I mean, for the 24 to even be at this point and control his own destiny is simply mind-boggling to me. Do we think he can channel some of that same magic that he was able to garner in the spring?
Well, we'll see. I don't know what to think of Willie B here. I know that if we take a look back at the spring race, remember the day before he ran the truck series and was able to start, I think he started, had to start last or at least deep in the field, and was able to drive up through and win. And I think those were some of the cooler Martinsville conditions we've ever seen. And I think maybe that set him up for, you know, some confidence to get into that cup race. Now, I do think that the trucks in the Cup Series drives more similarly than the Xfinity. I think Xfinity is kind of the you know, a very different package in which they run. And now I'm not saying that there's a direct correlation, but I will say that I feel like guys that run that truck race or even an Xfinity race, they're one adjustment ahead of the field. They know the feeling that they had in the race car the day before, and they're able to say, hey, listen, I had this yesterday and, you know, we took out a round of wedge and that, you know, fixed some of the problems that I was having, and I was able to get back to the gas sooner, whatever it may be. And I don't know that he's going to have that this, obviously I know he's not going to have that this week. And again, I'm not getting involved at 8-1 either. I just think I'd rather see him run well in practice and qualifying. And listen, if he qualifies 7th or 8th, you're going to see a higher price than 8-1. And so if he doesn't qualify in those first two rows, I don't think you're losing out on any value with William Byron. And if he slips up in qualifying, you're going to get a way better price on him. So I would say let's just wait and see on him as well.
Last two drivers, I want to hit on Christopher Bell in that 15-1 range and Ryan Blaney in that, let's call it 7-8 range. You look at Christopher Bell, obviously still trying to recover from a rough day at Las Vegas 2 weeks ago, ran up front at Homestead, finished 11th, obviously faces an uphill battle to make the final four in Phoenix. Flat short tracks have been his preferred. You look at what he's done, not known as a Martinsville expert, mainly because the Xfinity Series didn't really run here, so he didn't have a chance to get the same level of experience he did at New Hampshire, Richmond, and Phoenix. When you look at the way Christopher Bell has gone about maturing as a driver this season, 14-1 I'll throw out there, but also want to kind of blanket, you know, some of this discussion with Ryan Blaney. Likely has a little chance of advancing without a win. He was good at Martinsville in April, finished 4th. But matching that likely won't be good enough for this Team Penske driver. And when you try and figure out Ryan Blaney, this is one of his better tracks, but it feels like something has been missing. And we've said it almost every single week with the 12. The thing that I found most troubling with the 12 worm had nothing to do with what he accomplished on track. He sounded like a broken driver in his post-race interview, given some of the mistakes he's made that has put his team in this particular spot with a win-or-go-home mentality this weekend.
I think on top of that, he hasn't won a race. I mean, Denny Hamlin came out this week and said he'd rather win 60 races than win a championship. So, I mean, think about that. Yes, he has to be happy that at least he has a chance to get into the championship four and then race at Phoenix, a place where he's, I think, in my opinion, one of his best tracks. But he hasn't won a race, and I think that he's had the speed to win. And he just hasn't been able to overcome as a driver some of the mistakes that he's made or his team has made. Whereas some of these other guys that have able to win races have overcome some of the issues or some of the problems, whether it's pit road or whether it's spinning yourself out on the end, the exit of pit road. And so he seemed a little dejected. And I think that just, I think drivers are really prepared for a race where it's hard to pass. And he knows that if he doesn't qualify well, it's going to be a long day. And, you know, there's going to be conservative drivers out there like Chastain and Elliott. I don't think that they're going to be taking many risks. And remember, any wreck that happens at Martinsville usually isn't race ending. Usually it's just a caution and you're able to fix your car and you're still able to compete. So it's not like someone's going to get taken out of the playoffs. Well, I guess that could happen. I don't want to say it won't happen, but it's less likely at Martinsville.
Paging Matt Kenseth.
Well, yeah, exactly. Well, that's a different story. But yes, you're right about that. And yeah, as far as Chris Bell, I mean, I almost like his championship price at 100-1 more than I like his price at 14-1 here. Like, if you think he's going to make it to the chance, or if you think because he's going to have to win the race, I think you take that 100-1 price and you're able to hedge out of that going into Phoenix. But here's the thing I'll say about Chris Bell. Tires didn't matter at the Roval until Chris Bell got them, and they mattered. And so if that happens at Martinsville, and maybe you see he's running like 8th or 9th, and there's a caution with 20 to go, and he's the first to take tires. Everyone's like, oh, tires don't matter. And he goes down and he straps on 4 fresh tires. I trust him as much as anybody to work his way up to the field. If he restarts 12th, or row 6th with 4 fresh tires, and he has to go get a win with 20 or 30 to go, I trust him as much as anybody to get that done. So if you use the Roval and the fact that tires didn't matter there, yet tires won the race for him, maybe it could happen this week at Martinsville. But again, like I said, I like that 100-1 price more than I like that 14-1 price to win this week.
Can't argue with any of that logic in terms of trying to figure out the best value and more bang for your buck there. Looking to try and go after the big fish instead of just trying to pick off the particular race price. There were a couple of drivers that I had marked down as well for non-playoff drivers that are going to have potential say in who grabs the checkered flag this weekend in Martinsville. But I want to open up the floor to you and know if there was a driver or two that you think we should be keeping our eye on.
Well, I think you can just go with the people that are on our list.
All right. I can rattle some of those guys off at, you know, somewhat long shot odds, and we can kind of go in reverse order here. AJ Allmendinger's price, 40-1. Brad Keselowski, 30-1. Kevin Harvick, 18-1. And Martin Truex priced at 10-1. Oh, how fitting it would be if the 19 was able to grab a checkered flag in this spot, given how dejected he sounded last week, even though he didn't have a car that we thought was the best at Homestead.
Yeah. I mean, he was second best, you know, which is crazy because it wasn't like he was second best by a little. Like, he was second best by a lot. Like, the third place car couldn't hold a candle to Martin Truex Jr. And sadly, he couldn't hold a candle to Kyle Larson. So, kind of bummed out for that 19 team because I've kind of become a Truex fan over the years. And here's the deal. If he shows up, he just hasn't qualified well. Like, Truex hasn't qualified well all year. And I don't think that 10-1 price is going to get, I don't think you're losing out on any value. I don't think he's going to qualify particularly well. He might be able to race well, but if he doesn't qualify well, you're going to see that price get inflated a little bit. I'd wait on him. And as far as Kevin Harvick, you know, he's the closer. He's going to look terrible in practice. He's probably not going to qualify well. And then, you know, he'll just be there at the end.
Stop if you've heard this before. Kevin Harvick will start 32nd in the field. He'll get steamed against in race day head-to-head matchups and yet find a way to work himself into the top 10.
Yep, that's my take on Kevin Harvick, and that's just a broken record week in and week out. He's going to look average in practice, he's going to qualify average, and then he's going to race way better than both of those.
How about the other two guys, the long shots? Okay. Brad and AJ.
I'll tell you what, Brad showed some speed last week, and I don't think he got nearly as much credit as he should. I know that I missed a massive bet on Brad K being top four at 20-1 last week, and there was no question that, you know, after practice, I should have bet that, and I missed it, and I got to get better about looking at, you know, all the options. But I think that I trust Brad Keselowski as a driver as much as anybody, especially here at Martinsville. He's won races, and he's been super fast, and if anyone, you know, can take a car and horse it to win a race, it's that guy. I have not played him, but I do think that there could be some value there. And don't be shocked if he does put it together a good qualifying effort. You know, maybe I don't know that it'll be a top 10, but 12th or 13th. And he'll be able to pass cars if he's got a good handling car underneath him. And then AJ Allmendinger. I'm very high on AJ Allmendinger. I know he didn't have a great run here in the spring, but he also didn't have a ton of speed in that 16 car. And I think that there's speed there now. And I think that AJ Allmendinger does provide the best value in the outright market at this point in the week.
Hey, it makes a ton of sense. When you look at AJ, he's talked about Martinsville being the one track that's an oval that races a lot like a road course with the high braking zone. He obviously prefers that to try and go in there and be able to make his passes. And much like Noah Gragson, they're the only two drivers that are going to get track time in the Xfinity Series the day before as well. So it's always interesting to see how those guys take the lessons that you kind of talked about for William Byron on the truck side and are able to apply it in the Cup Series to have one adjustment ahead of the rest of the field as they try and make their cars better throughout the course of the race. Encourage all of you as we wave the checkered flag and put a bow on stage three to follow Chris on Twitter at ChrisWormy15. I'm Todd Furman. Follow me there. Most importantly, follow the all things Bet the Board at Bet the Board Pod. Worm, before we close up shop with the penultimate race of the season, we have to relive some of our glory from last week where the pre-week race matchup we gave out loses by one spot with Joey Logano coming in right behind his teammate. The race day matchup gets there with relative ease, and of course we tipped our hand a little bit on the outright and Kyle Larson. Hopefully our listeners read the tea leaves there and were able to get down a few crumbs there at prices of 8-1, upwards of 10-1. Where do you see a pre-week investment opportunity for us this weekend at the Paperclip?
Well, we just touched on him, and I think that's AJ Allmendinger, and I don't want to take his outright price. Now, if you're going to do that, make sure you take it very small. Just full disclosure, I do have a small position on AJ at an outright price, but nothing. I didn't back up the Brinks truck or anything, that's for sure. I just think if he qualifies well, he's got race speed, and he's got the confidence at this racetrack, I could see him win. Where I like is his top 10 bet. I'm looking right now. It's pretty much even money or a little bit better at some places, so make sure you shop around, because I've seen up to plus 130 on that, but even money or plus 100 pretty much everywhere. I would say that is the bet of the week, AJ Allmendinger top 10.
Now, you mentioned AJ Allmendinger worm on the cup side. Can I interest you at all at his Xfinity price if you're able to grab double digits as a pre-week investment as well?
Yes, you can. I love that 12-1 price. Absolutely. I think he's going to be hungry for a win in that Xfinity series. And I don't know. I wonder if there's a sweep price. If AJ Allmendinger wins the weekend, what would that pay out? Whew, I'd be interested
pretty
in that.
Pretty healthy parlay. There are plenty of regulated books, some of which are NASCAR partners, that you may be able to parlay that and go all in on the dinger this weekend at Martinsville. I like you thinking outside the box, trying to catch lightning in a bottle with a driver that sets up nicely to kind of surprise some people this weekend. All right, my friend, we have one more of these fine shows to go before we wrap things up for the season. Were there any other nuggets or tidbits you'd like to share with our listenership before we bid them a fond farewell and regroup, knowing who the four drivers are remaining that'll be vying for a championship?
Well, it was nice to get one of my biggest wins of the season at Homestead with Kyle Larson, and I still think that has me down career on Kyle Larson at Homestead. So I'm going to need to back this up with another win here in the near future on Kyle Larson at Homestead to be positive at that track, sadly as it is.
It is a long season and a long, prosperous racing career for the five, I'd imagine. We'll see how the schedule shapes up, but we know where Homestead will fall on next year's calendar, and I have to imagine the five will use that as a launching point to get himself into the final four. So for Chris Wormy, as always, a special thanks to NASCAR, whose support for the Stay Green podcast has allowed us to continue to grow throughout the course of this racing season. Want to wish all of you, our loyal Stay Green listeners, the best of luck with all of your on-track investments this weekend, and with an AJ Allmendinger ticket in hand both Saturday and Sunday, hopefully we'll see you at the window.